Good morning. We're here for argument, the first case in the combined cases of Dahlman and versus Ritter and Ritchie versus Ritter. I want to advise the parties that two of our members are not participating in this case, Justice Coates and Justice Ide. I also want to welcome all the students. I understand we have some students who are here this morning to watch the arguments. So we're now ready to hear from the petitioner, appellants rather.
May it please the court, my name is Maurice Kneiser. I'm here today on behalf of Governor Ritter and Rich Gonzalez. I would like to propose to divide my argument into three parts. First, I'd like to discuss the language and interpretation of Amendment 54. And I'd like to talk about the constitutional tests to be applied in this case. And next, I would like to review the application of the various constitutional tests that have been argued and indicate that under any of the constitutional tests, the defendants should prevail in this case. Amendment 54 was enacted by the voters in November 2008. It amended the Constitution's campaign and political finance amendment to ban contributions to candidates by persons who have and hold sole source contracts.
Well, before you get any further, I wanted to ask you, that's one thing. This is an amendment to Article 28, right?
Correct.
And I noticed that in the briefs, various of the briefs anyway, used references in other parts of Article 28. Was that explicit by the adoption of this amendment or the enactment of this amendment, or is that just by implication because of it being placed within 28?
I did not see anything in the language of the amendment itself or in the blue book that indicated that made a direct reference to Article 28. I think it's just by the fact that it was placed in Article 28.
Okay.
It would be an amendment just as any other. If you amended a statute, you'd have to look to the entire statute, not just to the language of that particular amendment, to determine its scope and content.
Okay, so please go ahead.
Thank you. The ban on contributions is really twofold. One ban has to do with contributions involving candidates. The second ban has to do with contributions involving issues. The ban on contributions to candidates runs for the term of the contract and for 2 years thereafter. It requires that each sole source government contract incorporate a statement that contract holders must cease making, causing to be made, or inducing by any means a contribution directly or indirectly on behalf of the contract holder or the contract holder's immediate family for the benefit of any political party or for the benefit of any candidate for any elected office of the state or any of its political subdivisions. What that means is, in essence, is that if a contract holder who has a contract in excess of $100,000 statewide cumulative, that person or that entity cannot make a contribution for the term of the contract and for 2 years thereafter. It's important to note what that particular provision does not do. The measure does not prevent contract holders from contributing to a candidate or a political party prior to executing a sole source contract. The prohibition applies only to contributions, not to expenditures, not to any other form of political activity, and only during the term of the contract and for 2 years thereafter. The other prohibition is that it prohibits persons who have made contributions intended to promote or influence the results of a ballot election from entering into a sole source government contract relating to that particular issue. It defines a contract holder as any non-governmental party, including a person holding at least 10% ownership in a corporation or a partnership or so forth, or that party's officers, directors, or trustees. It also includes within its definition labor organizations who have collective bargaining agreements for which they are the exclusive representative, and any political committees created or controlled by the labor organization. It then goes on to define a sole source contract to include government contracts that do not use a public and competitive bidding process in which at least three bids are solicited prior to the award. And one of the key factors there is the term solicited. All the government would have to do is to issue a bid request through an RFP process and ask for three bids. It does not have to receive three bids. With regard to contractors that are not labor unions, the bans do not apply until, as I mentioned, the contracts total more than $100,000 annually for all sole source contracts that the contractor has with any government in the state of Colorado. Collective bargaining agreements are deemed sole source government contracts if the contract confers an exclusive bargaining status to bind all employees and to accept the terms and conditions of the contract. As I mentioned, it also includes the political committees of those organizations. In their answer brief, the Ricci plaintiffs argued that the sole source government contract include all contracts for which the government does not solicit at least three bids. The all-inclusive interpretation, we believe, is inconsistent with Amendment 54. Amendment 54 has two primary purposes. First, as noted in the Blue Book, it is intended to ensure that contractors do not influence policy decisions through campaign contributions. If a government does not have any discretion with regard to a sole source contract, then a contribution by definition cannot influence that policy decision.
Excuse me, did you say that this was the sole or one of the primary purposes is relating to influence contributions made by holders of contracts?
Yes, and
not
that,
prospective.
I'm sorry?
Not prospective contract holders.
No, as I read Amendment 54, it does two things. Amendment with regard to contributions to candidates or political committees, the entity or the individual that has can make contributions prior to entering into the contract. So, for example, if there was an election in November of 2008 and the organization or an officer or director made a contribution, then and that contract was, they could then execute the contract if it's in excess of $100,000. But during the period of the time that the contract is held for 2 years thereafter, they could not make a contribution.
Okay. And it seems that what you said, and I had missed this in reading the language, and tell me whether this is correct or not, that when the organization or person enters into the contract, they already have notice that they're going to have an implied inclusion of this provision in the contract. That's how it functions. So there is some kind of advance notice.
Correct.
And there's a quid pro quo in entering the contract, apparently. Is that right?
I'm not sure I term it quid pro quo, because under, as I read the amendment, Section 15 of the Campaign and Political Finance Amendment has to be included in each of the contracts,
right.
And in fact, that's how it was interpreted. And, you know, it basically becomes then a constitutional requirement, just as in other instances, there may be statutes whose terms are either implicitly or explicitly required to be in a contract, and that's true here. So basically, it allows people to make the contribution. It allows entities to make the contribution beforehand, but not during the term of the contract.
But a condition of having one of these contracts is that this is a contract term.
Correct.
Mr. Kneiser?
Yes.
In your reply brief, you said, and you mentioned this just before you started answering questions, you mentioned that the purpose, or one of the purposes, was to, of Amendment 54, was to limit the reach of the measure to those contracts where government officials may exercise discretion. And I guess I kind of don't understand how that relates to the actual language of 54. And I also don't understand how it relates, the idea of discretion by the government relates to the changes that you say we should make in the amendment. In your reply brief,
yes,
you give various about six things that you say we should construe in a way to narrow it consistent with the purpose. But fundamentally, I don't understand how the language reflects the discretion that you're seeking.
Well, I think if you look at the definition of sole source contract in section 14.4, it says sole source contract means any contract that does not use a public and competitive bidding process. There is no definition, though, of government contract, and this is where it becomes a bit arcane. So, for example, if you look at certain agreements or contracts that are entered into, for example, Medicaid contracts, it's basically a qualification. If a doctor or a hospital has meets the qualifications, all they do is they sign an agreement saying that they're going to abide by the rules that are set out by federal government or the state government under the Medicaid program. And so we think there is some ambiguity in the statute that would allow for that.
Where is it?
Well, because it talks about any government contract, and government contract is not defined per se.
So how do you want us to read that?
Well, I want it to be read really in light of two issues. One is
what's the language? I mean, here, you get up here and tell and write. What do you want us to say this means?
Well,
does it mean any government contract?
I'm sorry.
Does it mean any government contract?
Well, it means any government contract that does not use a competitive bidding process.
Right. Well, why wouldn't that include a Medicaid contract?
Well, because...
And also, why should it include a collective bargaining agreement while you're at it?
Well, let me answer the Medicaid question first, because the Medicaid question, I think you have to refer back to the Blue Book, which was referred to the voters, and the voters are sent to the voters. And the voters indicated that there was a presumption of impropriety that was involved in the process of issuing contracts. By definition, there cannot be an impropriety when there is no opportunity to exercise any discretion. If I'm going to give a contribution to somebody with the intent of influencing their decision, they have to be able to make a decision.
Well, what's the discretion inherent in a public collective bargaining agreement?
Well, the collective bargaining agreement is somewhat different because the collective bargaining agreement is specifically, I've got two answers to that. One is that it's specifically included in the definition. And the other has to do with, excuse me, the unique nature of a collective bargaining agreement. There is discretion, for example, that is involved in collective bargaining agreements. As I understand it, entities, whether they're schools or fire departments or whatever, are not required to enter into collective bargaining agreements. So if I am or to necessarily enter into terms that are favorable. So if I am a union making a contribution I am able to elect board members or contribute to board members who are going to be favorable to my opinion, then one of two things will happen potentially. One is that they may make a decision to enter into a collective bargaining agreement anyhow, or in the first place, and then there may be some discretion with regard to the terms of that collective bargaining agreement. So in that circumstance, there are discretionary issues that can be decided.
So wait a second. So what is it we should add to 14.4 to make it consistent with what you say the purpose was?
Well, I think...
What words? What should I write, and then what should the majority opinion say? Government contract that exercises discretion?
No, I think you can interpret it for example, in Buckley versus Vallejo, there was concern about the term for the purpose of influencing. The Supreme Court in that case thought that the term was too broad, and so they incorporated the major purpose exception into that. And I think here it's actually an easier transition for the court to make, because if the court were to issue a majority opinion, they could, the court could interpret government contract to mean those government contracts where there can be some discretion that is at stake.
Mr. Gneiser, maybe I'm just not understanding your argument, but if you look at the Blue Book on page 18, it says, what is the scope of local government contracts affected by Amendment 54? And it says, local governments also enter into collective bargaining agreements when it's discussing the scope of. So it certainly seems that they're mentioning collective bargaining, local government collective bargaining agreements right there in the Blue Book.
No, they are. And I think.
And so, I mean, and they're saying that they're covered.
And I'm agreeing with that.
Okay.
I was trying to answer Justice Bender's question about why collective bargaining agreements are included. And in fact, they are included in the definition of sole source government contract. So I was just kind of responding to the question as to why it makes sense to include them. What kind of discretion do they have?
Well, is that section 17? Is that where that's coming from?
No, actually, it is in
14.4, I think.
14.4. It's the very last sentence of the definition of sole source government contract.
Mr. Kaiser, as far as your attempt to narrow the definition, if I understand your argument correctly, of any government contract to mean any government contract in which some discretion is exercised, and the map or the road to that is because you're saying this is only intended to cover government contracts where there's a risk of impropriety. Or a risk of undue influence. I'm just a little concerned that that's a rather large hole to bore into any government contract, because it seems to me that there are lots of other circumstances that you would have to analyze for whether there was any such risk or not, depending on such things as, I suppose, whether there are other providers out there that might be able to bid on the contract. If there's a government need and only one provider, then that would seem to fit within your the hole that you're boring as well. I could probably come up with other examples. Is it your intention that really is that wide a hole, that many contracts that one would not question as being government contracts in any other context suddenly are not, because there's no risk of influence?
I think for purposes of this amendment, we can add that discretion. I agree with you, with the fringes, there may be some concern. But I would also argue, again, referring back to Buckley versus Vallejo, when they added a major purpose test, the court, in order to narrow the term for purposes of influencing, that term has been litigated. Because it itself, at its boundaries, was somewhat unclear, but that has not forced the U.S. Supreme Court to back off from that narrowing of the definition. So, but you're absolutely right. At the fringes, there would be some question.
But the purpose of that is to fit into a First Amendment test of some sort, which you're going to tell us which level of scrutiny that is and so on. But the rationale the government has to articulate has to be picked up through the legislative history here, because it isn't in the language itself and the applicable First Amendment tests.
I think that the first thing, as I understand it, that the courts do when interpreting a constitutional amendment is really twofold. If the language is ambiguous, then they will interpret it in a way that's constitutional. And sort of related to that, if there is a way to interpret it in a constitutional manner, it will do so. And so the argument here is that the term government contract isn't necessarily itself clear in these circumstances. And we think there is an opportunity for a narrowing interpretation.
And the narrowing has to be a government contract where the government exercises discretion.
Right.
Is that right?
I mean, that's the practical interpretation. Let's assume that the court does not feel that it can go that far, then it is true that it covers any governmental contract. We just don't think that was consistent with the intent, because the whole idea was to avoid undue influence, and you can't have undue influence if for example, your utility.
Well, yes, but I mean, whose obligation is it to tailor this thing in such a manner that it addresses the purpose instead of strikes too broadly? The courts?
To the extent the language is ambiguous, it does fall to the court.
Well, is this language ambiguous? Because it's, I mean, I'm having trouble with that. It seems that any government contract is not ambiguous, that the ambiguity is injected because of the concern about whether it addresses the purpose or strikes too broadly.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think that, let's assume, for example, I don't think that it's any governmental contract is necessarily by itself unconstitutional. I just don't think it was intended to go that far, frankly.
That's, I think, what's frustrating all of us is, if it's not unconstitutional, I mean, isn't that the entire purpose of our conversation today?
Yes.
And so why do we care whether it was intended or not to go that far? I think, for me at least, every brief has suffered from this problem of focusing on the problem at hand, which is there was a preliminary injunction enjoining, I guess, on the basis that this is likely to succeed to be unconstitutional. You're saying, well, maybe it's not unconstitutional, but it could have been written better. And that's not very helpful in terms of the procedural posture, for me at least. Mm-hmm. So try to ratchet down. Tell me why you think this preliminary injunction should be reversed.
Well, as a practical matter, I think it should be reversed because we believe that the district court was wrong on a number of levels. You know, the issue of...
Okay, this just be as specific as you can.
Okay. Well, for example, the court seemed to have been concerned not so much about all of the... She thought... Justice Lemon thought that the contract, it was overbroad because of its effect, as I understand it, on contributions. She also talked about the fact that it covered officers, directors, and 10% shareholders. One of her concerns there was that really for many of the nonprofit corporations, or even for other corporations, the boards of directors and the trustees and so forth may not really influence the decision. They may not even know that these contracts have been executed. Our argument to Judge Lemon and to this court is that 10% shareholders, officers, directors, by definition, either know or should know about these contracts, particularly because they're in essence over $100,000. They're substantial contracts, and it's difficult, especially for entities like corporations or partnerships, to act outside of the without somebody making a decision. So we disagreed with her there. She had some concerns, for example, about the question of the harshness of the penalty. Was our argument, first of all, that as the court had looked at those penalties, that the court was not paying attention to the fact that there was substantial requirements, knowing or intentional, are required before any of those penalties can be invoked. She was also concerned about the fact that a public or a citizen could enforce these matters, and in fact, I think she felt that that was subject to abuse. Our response to that is that there was already a private enforcement mechanism in Article 28, and in fact, it hasn't been subject to abuse over the 4 or 5 years that it's been in effect.
Well, at the root of this, however, is her concern, and I assume that this has to go right to the core of this, is the incredible sweep of the disqualification to contribute to any person, local, state, elective, mm-hmm. board, special district, etc., not just to the board that where this pay-for-play concept might arguably have some kind of reasonable nexus to it. Would you comment on that? It seems
yes.
Punitive.
I think what it really boils down to is the concept of how government in Colorado is structured. So, for example, you know, there is a question as to whether, or not, if, during the course of her opinion, she listed, you know, the fact that there may be thousands of local governments, whether they're special districts or counties or cities throughout the state, and how can you lump them all together and, in essence, make contributions to any one of those a part of a whole? And I would just point the court to the recent decision by the U.S. Supreme Court in the USURA case, which dealt with the question of whether or not the state of Washington had the right to compel local governments to not take payroll deductions for purposes of funneling union dues to the unions. And the Ninth Circuit in that case had held that the state itself had the right to refuse to not deduct the union dues, but that the state could not compel local governments to refuse to deduct the union dues. And what the court in USURA did was to, the Supreme Court was to say, no, the state has the right to look at the state as a whole. And even though those local governments are separate entities, the state has the right to consider the effect on the body politic. So I think, and there have been some other cases, for example, the Reeder case and the Waxman case dealing with the ability of police officers to contribute to people at the candidates at the local level, the state level, or the national level. And the courts have almost uniformly, not quite, but almost uniformly upheld that, even though a local police officer may not have much impact on a federal official, and in part it's because of how it appears to the public. That is the major problem. So in Colorado, I think we have some of the same issues. Each government is not necessarily a separate entity. So for example, school finance. School finance is really a question of what local governments do, how they collect their monies, and also what the state government does in terms of offsetting the property taxes under the school finance laws. There was recently a bill that was passed that we cited in our brief, where the legislature passed something called a regional tourism authority bill. And what this allowed the local governments to do was to, particularly counties, I believe, was to establish a regional tourism authority. So if I am somebody who wants to benefit by contracting with the regional tourism authority, what can I do? Well, I can contribute to a state legislator or to the governor in order to influence the passage of this bill. Say, I'm going to contribute, but I really would like this regional tourism bill passed. The regional tourism bill then basically delegates to local government the opportunity to set up this regional tourism district and to contract. So I could then contribute to county commissioners who will then perhaps influence, you know, that contribution may influence their decision to grant me the contract. So that's why, you know...
Wait a minute, that's an odd example, because there's nothing wrong with that, right? Because it doesn't come into play until after they're the contract holder. So I thought you spent a lot of time at the beginning of this argument explaining how they could make all these contributions until such time as they're awarded the contract. It's subsequently that they can't make the contributions.
That's right, because what is...
So all of those contributions to any special district or to the state senators or whoever it is that they think may have influence on the ultimate contracts that would be awarded if I think your example was a state tourism issue is passed, all of that can be done. It's only after they get the contract that there are restrictions. Is that correct?
With regard to candidates, that's correct. But I mean, I think you raise a good point, and I think there are two responses to that. First of all, I don't think that it would be at all feasible to have anybody, any contributor, kind of anticipate what's going to happen. The only way you could, I think, feasibly do what the proponents want us to do in this case is to put an after-the-fact limit on the contributions, because you don't know what's going to happen.
You're saying it's not practical to have proposed and passed a ballot issue or an amendment that would address the contributions that are made in pursuit of a contract. Mm-hmm. I don't understand that. Why couldn't contributors be prohibited from subsequently engaging in sole source contracts?
Well, in theory they could, but I think that would move it more towards, that would bring more into question the constitutionality. What the people have done here is to limit the impact. So they have not, in theory, I suppose they could have made the impact broader, but what they did was to narrow the impact by saying it would only be after the fact and prospective.
But oddly, they've narrowed it in such a manner that it actually precludes and doesn't cover actual attempts to influence the contract, and only subsequently covers prospective subsequent attempts or the appearance of that.
Well, you know, I think it's true in some circumstances, but let's look. Contracts usually have a term. They have a set term. So use the example of the regional tourism district. Let's assume that I enter into this contract with the commissioners, and it's for a set term. I can contribute to the commissioners under the law as it existed before Amendment 54. I could contribute to the commissioners during the term of the contract and then have that contract renewed, renegotiate terms of the contract more favorably, and so forth. So that would be another area, I think, where the contract, where the scenario that you raised wouldn't necessarily be the only area where there would be some impact. Because it could happen during the term of the contract also. There has to be a starting point here, and I think the proponents have legitimately said we are not going to prohibit contributions prior to the contract or prohibit people from entering into a contract. What we are going to do is to use the contract as the starting point, which is a legitimate choice that people can
have. Can I move you to your second point, which is really the test?
Yes.
As I see it, your fundamental argument for a rational basis test is that an independent contractor or a contract holder is really equivalent or the same as a government employee. And I guess I'd like to hear why you think that.
Well, actually, it's the Board of County Commissioners of Wabanzi versus Umber case, I think, that really is the pivotal point here. And it is the starting point. The Supreme Court in that case was trying to figure out what to do with a contractor who had a contract with Wabanzi County, who apparently had the contract terminated because of speaking out. And so the Tenth Circuit had held that violated the contractor's First Amendment rights. It went up to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the U.S. Supreme Court was faced with two diametrically opposed arguments from the county and from the contractor. The county said the contractor has no rights. We can do whatever we want. It's not really a First Amendment issue. The contractor said, no, I have the First Amendment rights of any other citizen out there. And what the court did, and I think the court took a very pragmatic approach, a functional approach, was to say, okay, look, what is this contractor doing? This contractor is acting as an employee. And therefore, we are going to, at least for termination of a contract, we are going to employ the same standard that we did for termination of an employee. And so it seems to me from that theory that the logical next step in terms of what we're doing here is to say contractors, because they are really carrying on the function of public employees in many instances, should be treated like a public employee, which then means that they are subject to the same constitutional tests with regard to their political activity.
Well, why wouldn't that test be the Garcetti case and the Pickering case?
Because the Supreme Court has treated political activity by public employees differently. And the reason I say that is because...
I missed the last part.
Oh, I'm sorry. Because they have treated political activities by public employees differently.
Their rationale has been, to promote government efficiency and taking a look at what the political activity of the government employee is in relationship to the person's job. I'm having trouble following that. I can certainly see where if this were proportionately tailored, let's put it that way, then I can understand how it would relate to a specific contract or a specific government employee, and I think you'd have a much better argument. But this thing is everything, and including the kitchen sink. And so I don't understand how there's certainly no question that a government, a private contract holder, has some aspects of their job that are comparable to a government employee. But to make them full-time, permanent government employees, as from a constitutional sense, seems to me a huge stretch.
Well, actually, I don't think so. For example, under the Ethics and Government Amendment.
What about that? Are you asking us to adopt the definition of independent contractor?
No, actually,
What's the purpose of you're supplying that in the reply?
Well, what I was trying to do is to indicate that it's not unusual for independent contractors to be treated as the equivalent of public employees. It's not a novel concept. And so it's been done in the Constitution. It's actually been done in the Personal Services Statute 2450501. Really, I think the analysis of the people in the Ethics and Government Amendment and also the legislature has been that when they are performing a public function, at least for that purpose, they need to be treated as public employees. Because if I'm going to do something that influences government action, it really, and I am carrying out a government service, it makes no difference, I think, from a practical point of view, whether I'm designated as a public employee or a contractor.
So a nonprofit, the Denver Symphony, for example, is considered a government employee because they have a sole source lease with the city and county of Denver?
Right. Because the nonprofits always, present this this image of not attempting to influence or not having an interest that could potentially be different from the government's interest or from the public good. And I would like to point out that in Federal Election Commission versus Beaumont, the Supreme Court dealt specifically with that issue, where a nonprofit entity claimed that because we're a nonprofit, we ought not to be subject to the prohibition on contributions to corporations. And the Supreme Court rejected that argument. If I can, I say I've only got about 2.5 minutes.
Well, yeah, but as long as Justice Bender raised this, it seems to me there's huge adverse public policy consequences with taking the volunteer board of directors and disenfranchising them from making contributions as they see fit.
Well, I've got two responses to that. Number one, I think the policy was determined by the people. And number two, by including everything, including nonprofit corporations. Number two is that, as I pointed out in FEC versus Beaumont, the court, I think, really didn't address, or the court did address, excuse me, the fact that you may have these volunteer small organizations. They still can't be subject to the limitations that have been imposed in this case. If I can, I'd like to reserve my remaining minute and a half. Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Jean Dabofsky. Doug Friedman and I represent the Ritchie plaintiffs, and I'm going to share my argument with Mark Gruskin, who represents the Dahlman plaintiffs, will split our time 20 minutes each. Amendment 54 is facially unconstitutional if a substantial number of its applications are overbroad in relation to its plainly legitimate sweep. If Amendment 54 was simply a ban on campaign contributions from independent contractors to elected officials with the authority over awarding the contract, we probably wouldn't be here today, because that could be a plainly legitimate sweep of Amendment 54. But that's not what it does. There is nothing as broad as this anywhere in the country. So although there are lots of cases looking at whether state contractors, for example, can make campaign contributions, all of those are far, far narrower. There's a second part to the facial invalidity standard. And I really want to begin with that, because I think many of your questions focused on it, and it makes sense, at least to me, to begin there. And that is whether it's facially unconstitutional if a substantial number of applications are overbroad in relation to its plainly legitimate sweep, unless a limiting construction or partial invalidation removes the threat to the speech. So I'm going to talk for a little while about what a limiting construction or partial invalidity would look like. And I think the easiest way to deal with that is to begin with the text of Amendment 54, which is attached to both the Ritchie plaintiff's brief and the Dahlman plaintiff's brief. And I'd like to begin with what I think is the core of the amendment, the provisions that the state does not suggest are severable. Those are three. One's the language, any contract. The other is the application to all levels of government. And the third are the disproportionately severe sanctions. To begin, the language on any contract appears in section 14.4. It also appears in one of the sanction provisions, subsection 3 of section 17. The any contract language is not qualified in any way. It is much like the any communication language considered in Colorado Education Association versus Rutt. It's broad and all-inclusive. And the court in Rutt said that you cannot imply limitations or qualifications not found in the text. Now, the state suggests that the language could be limited to where government exercises discretion in awarding the contract. But, of course, that language doesn't appear in paragraph 14.4.
Are you just focused on the first sentence of that?
I'm focused on sole source government contract means any government contract. And then it goes on to talk about soliciting bids and more than $100,000 in the aggregate in a single year. But it's the any government contract language that gives all kinds of basic problems with this amendment. They tend to be practical problems, because certainly not all government contracts lend themselves to competitive bidding. Most government contracts that lend themselves to competitive bidding are competitively bid.
I think in the reply brief, Mr. Kneiser suggests that it be limited to personal services contracts.
He does, but it doesn't say personal services contracts. And interestingly, personal services contracts normally are not contracts that are bid. The ones that are customarily bid are the ones for construction projects and for goods and supplies. Some personal services contracts can be, but many of them are very dependent upon the expertise of the person that the state has decided does not come within the expertise of people who are already state employees or local government employees. And these personal services contracts are used far more frequently the smaller the governmental unit. And you really do need to keep the same person providing the same services.
And you don't think that this language was, not that it necessarily could be, but that it wasn't in any event limited by the Blue Book?
No, I
quoted from that a little bit earlier when it tried to give some examples of what might be in and what might be out. You don't think that is, that provides any kind of limitation whatsoever?
Well, I don't think it helps much because it doesn't include very much.
Right.
I think that this Blue Book description, I know it has word limitations, but I think this Blue Book description is pretty unhelpful.
Okay, thank you.
Ms. Dabowski, Mr. Kneiser didn't, I think, make this argument specifically, but the notion that this is just, it says any government contract and that's the end of it, isn't entirely right, because, of course, it's followed by that does not use a competitive bidding process. And so that is part of the definition, really, of the contract. Now, it seems to me that Mr. Kneiser's argument about purpose, that is discretionary, really relates to that qualification in the sense that that perhaps it not only means not those contracts that don't use the competitively bid, but those that are susceptible to that. That is, those in which there is a discretionary decision about who gets the contract, but a competitive bidding process isn't used. That I am taking as the essence of Mr. Kneiser's argument. Hopefully I'm not ruining his argument for him, but I'd like you to respond to that. Why can't we interpret it in that manner, which would be rather narrowly?
Only those contracts in which government exercises discretion.
Because those are the ones that presume, as to who's awarded the contract, those presumably
That's right.
would be the ones that could be, that are susceptible to the bidding process, but the bidding process isn't used.
Well, and if this amendment had been written that way and had been limited only to the level of government that is affected by the contract and to the people who are responsible for making the decision about who gets the contract, we wouldn't be here.
Well, I understand that, but why isn't that a possible interpretation of this qualification? And when we look to that qualification of those that aren't susceptible to, or those that aren't bid,
it is.
Why shouldn't we look to the purposes and come out with that kind of definition?
Oh, I think you could, but I think you'd have to substantially rewrite this to do that. Moreover, the amendment is under-inclusive in that government regularly exercises discretion when it decides which of the competitive bids to accept. So it's not the only area in which government exercises the kind of discretion that the advocates of Amendment 54 were concerned about.
Well, yes, but that's a question of the things that it could address that might create some of the problems it's attempting to get to, but for whatever reason chooses not to. That seems to me to be similar to the fact that it doesn't address contributions before one's a contract holder.
And there would be the checks and balances there, too, of having other voices in the mix and considerations, where instead of the board is paying out the contract, you know, to one group or one person, it is eliminated. So, you know, we don't have to include everything that might have included, right? The question is, what about this one?
That's absolutely true. I think it reflects more, in most instances here, not quite understanding what drafting a constitutional amendment can mean. It needs to be more carefully done than this was. And I think a lot of the problems in this amendment come from some things that the proponents now wish they hadn't written into it. But we're stuck with what it says on the face of the contract,
and we,
on the face of the constitutional amendment.
And isn't that just inherent in the nature of having the initiative? We're stuck with this all the time in trying to interpret these because they're presented on a yes or no vote. And you can't say, I like this part, but I think you ought to tweak it a little bit.
Exactly. And so, that's what gives the courts difficulties in dealing with this. And it's also why there have been a lot of cases, including Randall versus Sorrell, which is a fairly recent U.S. Supreme Court decision, saying it's not going to rewrite the Vermont statute. Well, the Vermont legislature can take care of that, but the legislature here specifically cannot take care of the problems with Amendment 41 because Amendment 41 says that it can't.
Which is why I'd like you to stay focused on the point is, I think that you were starting with, which is, can this statute be saved? And you say, I think, that it can't because there are three sections that cannot be segregated. And the first is?
The first was the definition of any contract.
Right. And the second, if you're finished with that, if you could move on.
Is that it applies to the state or any of its political subdivisions.
Please.
And that appears in Section 14.6. It appears in Section 14.4, the middle of it, where it says includes all sole source government contracts with any and all governmental entities. And it also appears in Section 15, which the last sentence says, or the last, it's all one sentence, the last two lines say, for the benefit of any candidate for any elected office of the state or of any of its political subdivisions. So, it applies both to contracts at all levels of government and to elected officials at all levels of government. And I don't think you can take that out very easily. It's wrapped into the whole way this is put together. It also has, it's throughout some of the penalty sections. And the problem here with this language is that there is simply no nexus at all. Some of these restrictions on campaign contributions are not tied to a contract with a particular entity. And to correct that, if you wanted to narrow that to the official that has the authority or exercises the discretion over the awarding of the contract, you would really have a problem rewriting the provisions I just pointed out. And that's a substantial amendment and could take you probably several pages of text to make that clear.
What about the argument the state is the state is the state after all? You know? So well, why not all of it? And well, we just have figured out how to have these local organizations raise money, but it's really in the name of the state.
Well, if it had been limited to the state, it would make it much narrower. The state certainly provides the authorization for special districts to operate. The Constitution provides the authorization for municipalities to operate. Counties may be political subdivisions of the state, but they're separately elected officials. The people who provide the governance for all of these units are not elected on a statewide basis. So it just doesn't make any sense to apply this to everything that all of these officials may decide when there's absolutely no appearance of corruption to weigh on the government side when the government had absolutely nothing to do with the contract that the contractor entered into. Then the disproportionately severe sanctions. Those appear in 17, 1, 3, 4, and 5. Mr. Kneiser said that there had never been a private suit brought under the Article 28 private remedy provision. But the sanctions in Amendment 28 are far less severe than the sanctions in this case, with this amendment. And it seems to me that it would be all too easy for someone who's unhappy with somebody running for election, for a special district board, for the legislature, anywhere, to make a contribution or have made a contribution that would not be allowed under this amendment and then file suit. That ends that particular candidate's chances of election. It's a terribly severe sanction, and it is imposed on speech protected under the First Amendment. Anyway, all of those provisions would have to be stricken from this. And then if there were to be any enforcement, presumably the court would have to write what that enforcement should be. And the sanctions apply not just to contractors. They apply to elected officials, and they apply to appointed officials of government. So this can go anywhere with disqualifications from office, restitution of contracts, prohibition on entry into a contract. It's just a completely out of scale when compared to all other issues like this, where the remedy for a campaign contribution violation is through an ethics commission or a secretary of state, with very minimal.
So the people acting by initiative are responsible for cleaning it up themselves. I mean, that's what you're basically saying, because this is legislation.
That's correct. Let me go just briefly to the state's suggestions that portions of Amendment 54 are severable. I say this at a minimum. They would take out the portion of the definition of contract holder that includes officers, directors, and 10% shareholders, and the inclusion of labor organizations and their political committees. That all appears in Section 4.5. So they would strike Section 4.5, except for the first line, which reads, contract holder means any non-governmental party to a sole source government contract. Then on the definition of immediate family, they thought that could be severed. That's paragraph 8.5. It also appears over in section 15, the language of his or her immediate family member. They suggest that the 2 years thereafter might be stricken. That's in section 15. And they suggest that the ban on contribution for ballot issues could be stricken. We haven't talked about that much today, but that's clearly unconstitutional under U.S. Supreme Court and 10th Circuit case law. And you take all of that out, and what you're left with is what I started with, the definition of any contract, including all contracts, all levels of government, and severe sanctions. And those are the ones that either have to be substantially rewritten or they must be declared unconstitutional. Our argument has been that all of this is so intertwined that the court must declare this entire amendment unconstitutional. This is not one that can be saved by interpretation or rewriting.
I guess, I'm sorry, I looked like you were just finishing, but I if we were even to try to rewrite this statute along the lines suggested, how would we know what the actual intent was? How would we do this? How would we go back to the blue book and try to deduce?
I don't know how you would find out actual intent. We actually looked for some of the advertisements for this, and they'd all been taken off of the website. So I don't know how this was advertised, if it was. It seems to me that it's basically an initiative that decided to put together two different concepts. One was an effort to take labor unions out of politics, and the other was to couple that with pay to play. And I think that was probably an effort to make it seem as if this was not only aimed at labor unions. And there are pay-to-play provisions that are constitutional. It's just that this one isn't.
I guess my question is, if you take this statute and we take everything that the proponents of the statute have agreed is unconstitutional and we eliminate it, that list you just went through, and there's a few more things, I guess, we're left with a statute which you think is still deficient, cannot be fixed in any way because of the three areas that you're speaking about.
That's correct.
And what's our responsibility, you know, as a court to try to fix those three areas if we can? Where is that line between making an effort to try to fix those areas versus just saying, sorry, we can't do it, this is just unconstitutional?
I think most courts know it when they see it. Certainly there have been cases where the entire amendment, or in this case it was legislation in Randall versus Sorrell, the court said it's unconstitutional, we're not going to rewrite it. That's a limit on campaign contributions that was too low. It wasn't even a ban on campaign contributions. That's a U.S. Supreme Court decision in 2006. In 2009, just a few months ago, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court in DePaul refused to sever and to save a statute, I believe it's statute, that said that people involved in the gaming industry could not make campaign contributions. And they just said it applies to too many people who have, too many governments that have no interest in gaming. This is too broad, and we're not going to rewrite it. We're not going to sever anything. I think that happens quite frequently. And you'll see it in a lot of the U.S. Supreme Court cases in this area. It's because of the doctrine of overbreadth in the First Amendment. Courts are supposed to try to find a narrowing construction. But if you can't, if everything is too intertwined, then the cases all say courts should declare the entire legislative measure unconstitutional.
What about the General Assembly fixing this up?
General Assembly can't fix this one because General Assembly could adopt a statute in this area if it wants, but it says Amendment 28, Amendment 54, Section 13 says, legislation may be enacted to facilitate its operation, but in no way limiting or restricting the provisions of this article or the powers herein granted. I don't think the legislature regularly can amend the Constitution anyway, but the drafters of Amendment 54 wanted to make certain they couldn't. Thank you. If I may, I'll turn this over to Mr. Gruskin.
May it please the court. My name is Mark Gruskin. I represent the Dahlman plaintiffs. With me at council table is Stacy Layton, who represents Lawrence Botnick as part of the Dahlman group. Amendment 54 starts with a pair of deceptively simple propositions. The first is that contributions by a sole source government contractor, which is defined to include a public sector union with a collective bargaining agreement, automatically and irrevocably deemed and presumed improper. And the second proposition is that that presumption of impropriety triggers an outright ban, not just limits, that the ban applies to, as Mr. Bosky pointed out, any candidate, any elected office, any political subdivision of the state. These propositions are overly simple because, as Judge Lemon found below, a collective bargaining agreement shares none of the central traits of what is typically viewed as a sole source government contract. And without that commonality, there's no cogent link between Amendment 54's stated purpose and its application. There are at least five of those gaps. Number one, Amendment 54's central goal is to prevent a departure from competitive bidding in the government contracting process. But as to collective bargaining agreements, there can be no departure since there's no norm of competitive bidding. Second, the reason there's no competitive bidding with collective bargaining agreements is because it's the employee's decision and not the government's decision as to who will obtain that right of representation. Third, as such, a campaign contribution by a collective bargaining unit simply cannot affect whether or not a union will be chosen to fulfill that obligation. It has no relationship to the choice of who will have that particular role. Fourth, benefits of a collective bargaining agreement, unlike regular sole source contracts, don't flow to the contract holder. It flows to the employees through wages and working conditions and benefits that are established under the agreement's terms. And fifth, and this may respond to some extent to Justice Hobbs' question, because of what it is, a labor organization that's the exclusive representative of employees cannot escape the grasp of Amendment 54. In contrast, other contractors are free to make contributions by, as Justice Martinez pointed out, contributing early before the agreement sets in, or contributing contracting in a way that is limited to those where there are multiple bids only, or that their contracts amount only under $100,000. There are four issues that we'd like to address. Number one, frankly, rather than take you through them, I think that you've obviously read the briefs, they deal primarily with the level of scrutiny. We think first of all, and most importantly, that this is a contribution dam, subject to an exacting level of scrutiny. That is, that it be closely drawn to match a sufficiently important interest. The parties agree, and the Supreme Court's been very clear, the actuality of corruption or the appearance of corruption are the only interests that will sustain this burden. And the only thing that is advanced here is whether or not there's an appearance of corruption. So for you, we believe there are two questions. Number one, is appearance of corruption a remotely plausible state interest as to collective bargaining agreements, given some of the things I've just said? And second, only if it is there the requisite evidence that would reasonably lead to, as Buckley said more than 30 years ago, a public perception of corruption stemming from large donations?
Where does this evidentiary requirement come from, and what is its threshold? What needs to be shown?
The evidentiary requirement stems from Supreme Court case law. As recently, probably the most definitive statement on it is the Shrink, Missouri case cited in our briefs, where the court said the level of evidence that's required is dependent upon the novelty and the plausibility of the justification for the statute. So in this instance, you have a particularly implausible justification, since, frankly, the structure of collective bargaining agreements have nothing to do with the standard sole source contract. But the courts have said, in as recently as the McConnell case, that this is an absolute. The state suggests in its reply brief that the McConnell case stands for a proposition that the appearance of impropriety need not be established by evidence. That, frankly, is not the way we read that case. If you take a look at some of the limits that were evaluated, the court evaluated whether or not there could be an absolute limit on minors, whether they could contribute. And the reason they rejected that and overturned that part of the statute is that they said that the FEC had offered scant evidence, slim evidence, and failed to provide a convincing case of the claimed evil. On the other side of the spectrum, the court did sustain the prohibition on soft money contributions to political parties. And it did so at pages 150 and 151 and 52 because it pointed to the record, it said there was evidence of manipulation of the process. It said the record is replete with similar examples of peddling access. It talked about Buckley's deeply disturbing examples of corruption, and that if they did not secure actual influence, they certainly gave rise to the appearance of such influence.
Mr. Gruskin, you know, that's instruction dealing in the constitutional area, of course, but of a statute, a congressional statute. Here we have a constitutional amendment. So I think there are different, aren't there different concerns when we have to approach that and construing it?
I don't think that there are. And I think that this court's analysis in the Rutt case, for one, suggests that a constitutional amendment will be evaluated using the Buckley and its progeny, that analysis. We didn't get into the issue of appearance of corruption there.
Because nor did we get into evidence, as far as I can remember.
That's correct.
In terms of... So I kind of don't follow your argument.
All I'm saying is that the overlay, the Buckley overlay, is the same overlay that's required here. And the fact that it's a constitutional amendment, I know that the argument is made that there was a vote, and that vote is sufficient.
Reflects,
that's the evidence.
That's right. Reflects the will of the people. Yeah.
But frankly, the will of the people only goes so far. Even in the cases, even in Shrink, Missouri, where you had the will of the people, they looked at the kind of evidence that we're talking about. The court specifically cited tens of thousands of dollars of improper contributions and the appearance that had. So even with the vote of the people, in Shrink, Missouri, it was a 3-to-1 vote. Here it's barely 50-50. The court required that kind of analysis, even for a voter-approved type of measure. Even if there was an important interest here, and we obviously maintain there wasn't, this is not an interest that this was not a structure where it was closely drawn. The rationale simply doesn't match up with what collective bargaining agreements do, first of all. The state suggests in its reply brief that unions are the most likely to create the appearance of corruption through contributions. It's an interesting statement, but it isn't borne out in evidence in the record, and frankly, it runs headlong into where the
United States Supreme Court is. In the Abood decision that's cited in all the briefs, the court was taking a look at public contracting or public collective bargaining, and it was very clear, and I'd like to quote for you at page 232 of its decision, nothing in the First Amendment or our cases discussing its meaning makes the question of whether the adjective political can properly be attached to those beliefs the critical constitutional inquiry. The differences between public and private sector collective bargaining simply do not translate into differences in First Amendment rights. So the fact that these are groups that operate in a political sphere doesn't give them, or doesn't give the state, the license to somehow minimize their First Amendment exercise. Beyond that, clearly this isn't closely drawn. The state argues in its brief on page 18 that it was reasonable for voters to target public sector unions, and that's a quote, whose goal it was to obtain favorable results for the employees they represent. That is inherently problematic, and that would require you to step away from your analysis in Rudd. The analysis where you said that the guarantee of freedom of association in the political context protects the right of the union members both to express their views and to support their position financially. So it is very clear that targeting of unions in this context is simply not something that the First Amendment would withstand. The rational basis test, which the state argues for, is particularly problematic. It's problematic as a starting point in that no court has ever done that, not in this context, not in a campaign finance case. No court has ever walked away from Buckley and embraced the trilogy of Hatch Act cases. And my belief is that they've not done that for a reason. The case that we cite in our brief, the National Treasury Employees Union case, is instructive. What the Hatch Act does is it protects the First Amendment exercise of public employees. It doesn't restrict that. And that's not the intent, nor is it the operation of Amendment 54. Similarly, in the letter carriers case cited, the court was clear that you could sustain a regulation when it wasn't aimed at particular groups or points of view. And in the Broderick case decided the same day about a state Hatch Act, it said used almost exactly the same words. There is no way that this amendment can be argued as one that does not target groups or points of view. As a matter of fact, the state indicated that that was one of the justifications for closely drawing it, that these are the groups that are targeted. And even if the Hatch Act rationale applied, and we contend that it does not, it is the more appropriate balancing provided under the Pickering case that should be applied here, which is virtually the same thing as the exacting scrutiny, taking an important interest and balancing it against the speech concerns that are otherwise present. And we would suggest to you that if Pickering is the appropriate test, and if the court were to go to a more appropriate type of post-Hatch Act analysis.
Would you expand on this idea of the financial contributions and the points of view?
There is, the honest truth about Amendment 54 is this. As the state points out, it is not all that difficult, potentially, for a number of contracts to become exempt from Amendment 54. You would simply have to solicit more than three bids. There is no way whatsoever for a collective bargaining unit to escape from Amendment 54. Once it has a collective bargaining agreement, it is ipso facto forever subject to that restriction. And so
that is because the soliciting three bids doesn't apply to that part?
That's correct. And also because, frankly, it is treated differently. It is treated as if it is its own entity. It doesn't really have, it doesn't have a relationship with government other than to negotiate a contract. The importance there, obviously, is that if unions cannot escape the grasp of Amendment 54, then inherently there is no way for them to both act as responsible parties to a contract and also be able to give collectively on behalf of their members. And frankly, coming back for just one moment to the Hatch Act analysis, The Hatch Act is inappropriate because, again, that's about insulating employees. That's about taking them out of the stream of political thought in their day-to-day workplace. That has nothing to do with the analysis before you. Even if that was not the case, it's our contention that Amendment 54's treatment of union political committees violates equal protection. If this court were to uphold Amendment 54, it would be the only court in the land ever to have upheld a restriction both on the entity and upon its separate segregated fund.
Excuse me, what was the last part of that?
A political committee is often referred to as a separate segregated fund. So it's the political arm. And the United States Supreme Court, routinely upholds some various sorts of restrictions with the understanding that if you can't act here, there is another outlet for political speech. There is no such outlet here. And that was by design. That wasn't accidental, and there's no way to read it out of the wording here. The suggestion, frankly, that there's this differential treatment is somehow appropriate ignores the fact that any sort of differential treatment under an equal protection analysis has to advance the interest being proposed, can't simply be explained away. Here, the differential treatment of union political committees can't be justified on an anti-circumvention ground, as suggested in the state's reply. The entities that we're talking about are separate, entire entities. A union is a separate legal entity with its own First Amendment rights, separate from its members, separate from a political committee. Whether they coalesce or not is a secondary issue. The fact is, as separate entities, they have rights to engage in their own political conversation. This is an amendment that doesn't acknowledge that separate status. It also, frankly, ignores the fact that legislatures have used and courts have approved the use of political committees as a tool to save contribution bans where there was some tailoring, some appropriate justification for the ban. We also believe that the contention in the reply brief that unions are politically positioned in a way that no other entities are, and therefore their political committees can be constrained, is inaccurate. There is no influence in the award phase of the contract. It comes back to how these are different. There's no role for any sort of undertaking of a political committee to affect the award of a collective bargaining agreement. The decision as to who the representative will be is made by the union members. And frankly, I'd like to address just briefly the issue of ballot issues. I understand that there's been scant attention or time paid to it yet, but this is perhaps the most problematic, or at least every bit as problematic, notwithstanding the time that's been spent on it. The Supreme Court has routinely said that there is no appearance of corruption present in a ballot issue campaign. It just doesn't exist. And if that's the case, there is no rationale for limiting the speech of a collective bargaining entity in connection with a potential ballot issue that might affect it.
Well, could you elaborate on that? Because I read that somewhere in your materials, but I don't really understand what the Supreme Court means by that. Certainly, there is a potential for fraud and all kinds of different types of corruption in how you solicit the signatures. There's lots of things that could go wrong. So it must mean something else.
I think you're right. I think it does mean something else. I think it stands in contradistinction to the candidate appearance of corruption. The idea with in Canada campaigns is that the exchange of a campaign contribution or the transmittal of a campaign contribution to a candidate implies some sort of understanding, and that there will be an opportunity for the candidate, once elected, to have some sort of effect.
Quid pro quo kind of.
Exactly. But with an issue, if you give money into an issue committee, there's no potential for a quid pro quo. There's no possibility for a payback. as it were. And therefore, there's absolutely no justification for taking these contribution capacity down to zero. We would ask you, therefore, to uphold the preliminary injunction. We believe, actually, that the findings are so strong that, and the need is so great on a statewide basis, that the signal to be sent by this court is a very important one. Thank you.
With regard to the question of whether or not this the court would have the ability to eliminate certain sections that it may deem unconstitutional but retain the core of the matter, it seems to me that the Tenth Circuit, in two cases that we've cited in our briefs, will help the court frame that particular matter. One is Citizens for Responsible Government, which we cited in our reply brief, which is a 236 F3rd. The other is the Kaufman case, which is a 498 F3rd. And basically what both of those cases did was to address questions that arose under the campaign finance law. And particularly the Citizens for Responsible Government, what you'll see is the Tenth Circuit was able to interlineate certain portions of statutes involving definition of political committee and actually remove certain phrases. And we think that certain of the issues, such as the question of whether or not it extends beyond the 2 years and so forth, can be easily eliminated.
I just want to ask you a question.
Sure.
That you've given us some suggestions about how that could be done with respect to the any contract. How could that be done with respect to the all levels of government problem?
Well, because I think if you look to some of the language, and I don't have it, let me see if I can get it right here. There is specific language that I'm just not finding right
okay.
off the bat.
Thank you.
But I do.
Your time is up.
There. I apologize for that. I see my time is up.
Well, let me ask you, I didn't remember in the state's brief any position on the ballot title issue.
We did talk about the ballot title issue, and we did make a distinction, about the contributions to ballot issues.
Right.
We did make the distinction. The Elam case is out of the Tenth Circuit. And basically what the Elam case talked about was a situation where all potential ability to enter into any kind of contract, whether it was sole source or whether it was competitively bid, was eliminated if you made contributions in excess of $100. Our situation is different because we're focusing only on sole source contracts. And so there you're more likely to see the influence between the contribution and the potential results of the contribution. The other point that I'd like to make with regard to that issue is that with regard to the Bilotti case, the Bilotti case had a caveat in there about there being no evidence in the record that there was the potential for fraud or abuse within the process. And it seemed to me that that left open the possibility that if the state could make a showing, then there would be, at least that would be a grounds for allowing some sort of limitation. And our argument here is that we've got the appearance of corruption through a vote of the people. Thank you.
On behalf of the court, I want to thank all counsel for your arguments. The case stands submitted.